So many of you know and learn every day a little more that I am not in any way cool, but some things happen to me that end up putting me in cool environments much cooler than the ones I deserve to be in. So one of them would be backstage with Wu-Tang Clan because Method Man, for whatever his reasons, has taken a liking to some of the silliness that we do. And so I've gotten to know him a little bit, and I wanted to talk to Method Man about his career and really a biography of his life, just sort of how these things happened to him, because he was somebody who went through a great many struggles, then arrives at rap stardom, and then he's got to reinvent himself because he gets sort of bored with where rap stardom has taken him, and he decides, I'm going to be an actor, and he ends up doing that successfully as well. So this is a chronicling of some of the interesting paths that Method Man took. And Mike Ryan, how would you describe the shocking story in here without giving too much away, but you gasped, your eyes got real big. Method Man himself, after telling the story, covered his mouth with both hands because he couldn't believe that he had revealed that, I guess.
It's weird. You're like Sway in the hip hop game. You get these amazing revelations from the hip hop game.
Okay, that's all we're giving them, though. It's just it's Biggie adjacent. It's a Biggie adjacent story.
Right. Fat Joe once revealed something to you on Highly Questionable about Anthony Mason that made news. Just Google it. This is an extension of that story. You're not going to want to miss it.
All right. So here he is, Method Man. So, Meth, long before Wu-Tang, you're growing up, and what does that look like? To the stranger who's uninitiated, what are the details from your childhood most responsible for shaping you that you look back on fondly and negatively? Because a lot of people that I talk to in your position don't have a whole lot of regrets because they say, I got to who I am and where I am by, you know, crawling through some fire.
My first memory as a child, I was 3, and I can vividly remember the house we lived in. And the reason I can remember I was 3, because when I described it to my mom, she told me how old I was. I remember tearing the house down. I was always a very energetic child. Not too outgoing, because when outsiders came around, I got quiet. But other than that, I could tear your whole house up by myself. As I got older, dad wasn't in the picture as much. And we were staying with family in Indiana. So I went from Long Island to Indiana, and we stayed in Indiana. It seemed like forever, but it had to be like almost a year. And while I was in Indiana, I learned that every babysitter was an ass whooper. I got my butt beat a lot.
You were bad, huh? You were bad. Just a lot of energy.
Curious, more curious than anything else. I was an outside kid. You couldn't leave me inside, because if you left me inside, I'd tear your house up. I had a ball out there. It got me close to my mom's side of the family, my cousins in Indiana. And then we moved back to New York. And when we got back to New York, we were back to Long Island again. And I don't know, it was just different this time, because now we were older and more aware. I say I was about 6 or 7 years old. And my mom, like I said, wasn't with my dad anymore. And we were going from place to place, basically living with friends of the family or friends like that until my mom could get on her feet. Somehow, we ended up in the Bronx, living with my Aunt Rose and them. So I went from Long Island to Indiana, from Indiana back to Long Island to the Bronx. But this time we're not with our mom, we're staying with our dad now, or my dad's family, my Aunt Rose. And then my dad gets an apartment right next door, so now we're staying with my dad. And that was, the Bronx was different, man. There was a lot of bullies out there, you know. That's where I really cut my teeth at as far as not being a punk, because you couldn't be soft out there, you know. And I lived around a lot of Latinx and just hood ghetto black dudes, man. Well, everybody out there was ghetto, not just the black people and shit. But at the end of the day, my mom came back, and we were all living together, and my dad started his thing again, and she left him again. We ended back up in Indiana, except I'm a little older now, a little bit more rambunctious.
And tougher, right?
Yeah, way tougher. And not to mention, you know, I got my nickname Shotgun when I was about 4 or 5 years old. I was a shotgun, definitely. So, you know, my cousins in Indiana, I'm pretty sure they told their friends about their cousin Shotgun. And I lived up to every bit of every story they ever told. My reputation, I lived up to it. Destroyed my aunt's backyard with a sledgehammer. Got us kicked out of there. We ended up at my mother's sister's house. Something happened there. Don't ask me what. I must have did something else. And we were back to New York again. But this time we were a bit more settled.
Why were you destroying anything with a sledgehammer? Like, what is happening there? Do you have
We found a sledgehammer in the shed.
Okay, so it's not a rage problem. It's just you're just still rambunctious. You're still rambunctious.
Yeah, you know, just curious. And, you know, after I destroyed... Well, my aunt had a finely manicured lawn, front and backyard. And, you know, we're kids. We're outside. We're playing. And in the shed, she had a bunch of tools. We found a sledgehammer. And back then, I don't think they had underground sewage in Indiana. So we kind of lived next to like this, it was like a groove that went down. I'm guessing that was the sewage. And mice used to, you know, run back and forth through the yard. And we caught one, dug a hole in my aunt's finely manicured lawn in the backyard, found this sledgehammer and killed the mouse with the sledgehammer, like broke them in half with it. So now it's getting good to me. She has these little cement circles so you don't step on her grass when you're in the backyard. I started cracking those in half. Next thing I know, we were packed up and we got kicked out of that
place. That was it. Like, that was everybody out of my house. We can't have this. You're smiling in the retelling of the story, though. What are you smiling about?
I was a kid, you know, and when my mother went to work, she had to keep her fingers crossed because when she came home from work that day, my Aunt B needed to speak to her. And after my Aunt B spoke to her, we was packed up and we was up out of there. Yes.
What does it mean when you say, give me some of the details or the ones you're comfortable sharing about, I would not be punked. I had to learn that I would not be punked because that's how I grew up. And so, because that has to be learned. You don't just start that way unafraid of people.
No. I was afraid every time, but instincts kick in. And I had two sisters. I didn't have any brothers. So I had to fend for myself. And don't get me wrong, I ran from some of the fights, man. You're smart enough to know that you can live to fight another day, you dig? But it's just something about that environment that whatever the parents is experiencing, the kids are experiencing that same thing, but subliminally. It's not like they know what's going on, but they feel the same pain that their parents feel, and they take it out on the rest of the world. And unfortunately, I was one of the kids that a lot of kids like to take their frustrations out on, and I had to fight back and fend for myself, you know? That goes in stages, though, no matter where you're at, but it does get to a point where you whoop the right person's ass, you ain't got to fight anybody else anymore.
When did that happen? Give me that story. Like, what do you remember sort of when you crossed over into, okay, now this is not a person to be trifled with, we've heard the stories?
Probably when I started playing football. When I started playing football around 12, 13 years old in Long Island. And I had a fight with this kid named Jason. Ooh, and Jason was like, you know, he's a bully. He ain't bully me. I don't know why we got into it. We just happened to get into it. And I remember he hit me so hard, but it didn't faze me. It made me mad as hell. And I wanted to hit him back harder, and I did. And every time he hit me, I hit his ass back harder. And then they just broke the fight up, and it was a tie. I actually had a tie with the town freaking bully back in the day. And, you know, it was just at that moment, it was just like, ain't nobody pushing me around no more. I'm tired of this. That's it. And after that, you know, most of the bullies was my friends. And me and Jason was friends after that. So that was the turning point.
What was your life, in the years, the 5 years before Wu-Tang, like before you start the ascent, what do those look like?
Okay. Well, I didn't really have a plan. I didn't have like, what am I going to do? I didn't care at that point. It was more or less like I was 16. Sometimes in school, sometimes not. I did have a job. I was working at the Statue of Liberty. But when school starts, you can only work on the weekends. So that's what, a $60 check? during the summer, you're getting a little bit of money. So I wanted to work full time. I hated going to school. So I started going to work at the Statue full time. But music was always a passion of mine. Because when I ran into Raekwon the Chef, he asked me to hang out with him one day when I was 13. This is when I first moved back to Staten Island. And Chef was like, hang out with me. So I'm hanging out with him. And it was boring. I ain't gonna lie. I'm still young, you know, I'm still rambunctious. I wanna do shit, you know, but we just standing around conversating with dudes. Everybody acted older than their age when I moved to Park Hill. And I caught on pretty quick. And from there, we went into the staircase and they started burning. At this point, I was 11, 12, yeah, about 12, 13. And they passed it to me. I didn't know how to smoke. So I'm acting like I know how to smoke. And they start rhyming, but they sound like the people on the record. I'm like, oh, shit. So every day now, I'm looking for this same crowd because I'm so, I love music. And I'm so, I've never seen kids my age do it like the professionals. So now every day we in that staircase and I'm learning how to smoke and learning how to smoke and learning how to smoke. Next thing you know, I'm writing my own rhymes. You know what I'm saying? And my first rhyme I wrote was actually with Raekwon the Chef called I'm on a Mission. In that verse, I ain't even have a rap name. My name is still Cliff, you know? And I was just trying to get down with the GBK, Get Busy Crew. That was Kappa's rap collective, Cappadonna, who was the nicest dude on the island at that time. So me and Chef do this record or tape at the time. And, you know, it was hitting. So now I'm known for rhyming, but I only got one rhyme. So every time we in the staircase and we blowing one, I'm saying this same rhyme.
Do you remember it, by the way? Do you remember it? Is it like something that you would be proud of all these years later? Like that, it's a tough ask, I imagine.
I'm proud of everything I write, but it's two, maybe four lines. I'm on a mission. Don't get up because I'm taking no shorts to shoot a cap and it's like that. And I will give it no thought. Ugly girlies round the way, they want to get that rap. Don't try to rip. My name is Cliff. I'll put you out on your back. See, I even have a rap name then and shit. That's all I remember, though.
I love that, though. I love that it was just Cliff at the time. I mean, somebody's got to start somewhere. So,
you know what I mean?
So what ends up happening? Like, when do you realize you're good at it? When are you, you got to be obsessive compulsive about sculpting it, right? Like, this becomes an immediate obsession.
But I wasn't really writing. I was trying to write, but couldn't really put two thoughts together. I was still like a novice at it, but being in the staircase with them, hearing those same rhymes over and over and over and over and over again for months. When I moved back to Long Island, their rhymes became my rhymes. So now I'm in Long Island and I'm known for rapping, except the rhymes aren't mine. They're these guys. So once those rhymes got stale, I had to start writing my own. Started writing my own rhymes. They sounded good. So now this is my thing. Now I'm nice with it. After like four or five tries, I'm nice with it. I'm writing whole bars, 16 bars, 28 bars, things like that. Going out there slaying kids in Long Island. I get back to Staten Island and I couldn't wait to run into my G's. And everybody that I ran into, first thing I did was let them hear these new rhymes and they knew I was nice. Now I'm one of the OGs out there. Well, not OG yet, but you know, I'm one of the dudes out there known for rhyming. And we used to have these rap contests at the Park Villa. Anybody seen the Hulu series, Wu-Tang and American Saga, they saw that we were having these contests. They weren't exactly like they were in the series, but it was something like that. And Kappa used to win them shits all the time, but I made it my business to make it to every last one of them rap battles, man. I ain't never win, but I was always good. People knew who I was. You know what I'm saying? So I was a ghetto superstar way before I was Wu-Tang superstar. Then RZA had the epiphany because himself and GZA had previously had albums out respectfully. GZA on Tommy Boy. I forgot what label RZA was on. He might've been on Tommy Boy too. But the albums didn't do well. They basically didn't put them in a light that they were supposed to be in, who they really were. It was what the record label wanted them to be instead of letting them be them. So when RZA came out, when RZA had the epiphany to bring us all together as a collective, this was his second shot at getting it right. Not only getting it right, but doing it his way. he gained a lot of knowledge from being in the business that short period of time. And lo and behold, everything that he planned came to fruition, and we're here right now.
How would you articulate to the people listening how it is and why it is Wu-Tang resonates in a way that you've got multiple documentaries about you, that something about you, and it's partially, I think, authenticity, even though you say you're a great liar because all rappers are great liars.
Yeah.
How and why is it that Wu-Tang echoes all these years later where you spoke to something, you connected somewhere that is really unusual in the entertainment game, where never considered sellouts, always the group, the power of the group. Like, how did that happen? What happened there that makes it resonate like that?
I think the bottom line, the mystique of the Wu-Tang is changing, or we changed the game. I mean, at that point in hip hop, you've never seen that many dudes in one group and they all rhyme. I mean, we've had groups like Stetson Sonic, but they all didn't rhyme. We've had, Public Enemy, they all didn't rhyme, but you got 8, 9 individuals on stage. They all rhyme and they're all dope. Not to mention that they signed a record contract that was unheard of ever, where you have individuals within the group signing solo deals outside the group and outside of the record label, which madness, because now you got record labels that would usually cut each other's throats working together as a collective now. I mean, the fans, we owe the majority of our success to the fans, because when we first came in the door, nobody knew who we were, and it was all word of mouth that traveled, that got us to the place that we wanted to be. The fact that our music resonates with so many people, your guess is as good as mine. Why does, Led Zeppelin's music resonate with AC/DC music resonate with so many people? Why do they stick a Bon Jovi? I mean, hell, even Whitney Houston. It's just something about your moment in time. And if you seize it at that moment, you'll live forever. And I think that's what happened with Wu-Tang. Hell, we got a district in New York.
Is that the happiest? Like, if I ask you throughout entertainment, you've done a whole lot of things. Like, that time where you're young, you're hungry, you don't know anything, you want to get to money really badly. Like, is that time the best time? Or is there another time since then that has just felt better in terms of really living life the way that you want to squeeze life?
Before all of that, preteen, some of my teenage years, where you don't have a care in the world. I mean, you're broke. You don't have much. But in the area that you live in, everybody's broke. So it ain't as noticeable as you think it is, And it's just ignorance is bliss at that time. Then when you get older and you start to realize the things around you and the things that are going on, and you become more self-aware, that's when it gets tricky. That's when it's like, okay, now we have to play chess. We have to navigate, and you're forced to mature. Some of us, it takes a little longer than others. Others pick up on it really quickly. God bless them. Good for them. But at the end of the day, we're all just trying to find our space in this crazy world, man.
Fame and success come with some burdens you weren't expecting?
Yeah, absolutely. Like I said, introverted extrovert. I don't really take too kindly. I'm not going to say kindly. I tolerate certain things, but outsiders, I'm very, I won't say skeptic. I just get quiet around. I don't like to reveal too much about myself around people that aren't going to be around that long. So when the fame hit, and especially being in the forefront of the group, if you watch footage, you will see that I would tend to push myself towards the back more. Don't stand in front when we take pictures. I would stand in the back more. I wanted the focus to be more on the group than just myself. And it's crazy, when I dropped my solo project, I always had to explain to writers and people of that ilk how Wu-Tang was, how we didn't break up. My solo success doesn't mean I left the group. And if you ever came to any of my shows, you would hear that the crowd isn't saying Method Man, they're saying Wu-Tang, Wu-Tang. So that should answer all questions from there.
I remember one time with you, it was very quick, but it sort of had a whole lot of life lessons baked into it. And I don't know whether you can help me sort of with the mistrusts and the betrayals that happen in music and everything else. But I remember somebody had introduced himself to me as Wu's manager. And you just very quickly said, yeah, Wu's got a lot of people who say they're Wu's manager. So I just thought to myself, I'm like, yeah, I imagine a lot of guys are trying to get close to these guys because there are good things around these guys, but that would bring a whole lot of distrust because I don't need to explain any of this to you. You understand what I'm talking about.
Absolutely. Just for instance, just recently, some guys were arrested for scamming over 100,000 in merchandise, over 100,000 in hotel fees. Saying that they were part of the Wu-Tang Collective. And this is true story. Some down south guys, too, and they had rental cars, all kind of stuff, and they were saying they were part of Wu-Tang. They got caught, though, and they're in jail. But if you look at the guys, it's like, you got to be an idiot to even think they were Wu-Tang. You know what I mean? But it happens. It definitely happens, man.
What can you explain to me after Wu-Tang? I want to get back into some of the people that you ended up working with. But if I had said to you then, from there, you are going to become someone who is mainstream. You are going to become someone who America likes in a variety of different ways. You would have said what to me?
I would have said, yeah, that was the plan. But we wanted to do it where, damn, how could I put this? I didn't want to have to throw on a suit to be accepted, and I didn't have to, and I love that about it. I like the fact that I can sit in first class or on a private jet, dress the way I dress, and people, you know, not assume off top that I'm a rapper or a basketball player, even though that's what I am and stuff. Because now it's like some of the top executives dress like this now. You understand? And I love the fact that, you know, when you come in humble and people respect your humility and they accept you for it, I mean, that's great because all my work is done. I don't have to do much to impress anybody, you know, at the end of the day.
Did you have anybody that you were working with at the time who you were awed by? I mean, you worked with some of the greats, right? You worked with Biggie. Like, I don't know whether in their presence you were nervous or scared or confident or up for the challenge?
Well, not Biggie. Biggie was, me and Biggie just hit it off. It was like friendship off top, you know what I'm saying? And at that time, we were both on our way up, so nobody was really riding any. Nobody had hits, you know? Who I was really in awe of was Mary J. when we did the All I Need record. Love her to death. Who else? Shaq, when me and RZA did the record with Shaq, that was meta right there.
You're a sports geek. I've seen you geek out. Yeah. Like you are a little bit the child, Cliff. Cliff the child. Yeah, you're wearing your Jets gear now.
I mean, I'm a Long Island kid. We're Jets. We do Jets.
But you can't be proud of that team right now.
You know what? I'm going to keep it a buck. Like, okay, I get it. Let's just say this. Let's say that the players aren't responding to the coach right now. I will not talk bad about our coach while he's our coach, Mr. Gase, but the players are not responding to him at all. I love our offense somewhat. We need some coordination there, you know. But we have some gems. We got.
I do not want to talk Jets football with you.
I'm sorry, but LaMichael Perrine is looking good. Mims is on his way up. Darnold is back. I mean, come on. All we need is a coordinator. That's it. Okay, we can drop it now.
I'll give you Mims. That's fine. Okay. That's all I'm all giving right. you though. But it's 40 years of suffering from that team. People have been laughing at that team, but you're still wearing their gear proudly. Good for you. You are nothing if not.
That's what Rex was. That's when Rex was the coach.
You are nothing if not loyal. You have is that an Ed Reed jersey behind you? I don't even remember the Ed Reed Jets years.
Yes. He wasn't there too long. I think he was there for like a season, maybe, if that, you know. But it was dope having him there, and he signed that for me. That's a signed Ed Reed Jet jersey, by the way.
Can you share with us a good Biggie story? I've been I've been trying to find out for a long time, and Fat Joe got into some trouble because he admitted to us that Anthony Mason was the Nick that he was talking about. You just held your mouth with your hand. Wait a minute. What are you doing? Did you not know that? Or you didn't know?
I didn't know that.
You didn't know.
I didn't know that. No, Big was already gone by the time I even heard that record. Like, wow, I didn't know that.
So you have, I'm glad
now I got to look Anthony Mason up and see who his chick was. She liked to be pooped on. No, stop. Stop the Method Man.
That escalated.
Well, crazy Biggie story I can think of. Biggie, we were at the airport. And I mean, and the story prior to this is a little bit, well, it's not as good as this one. Because then people get implicated. But it was some shooting going on at the club. He had me come down to North Carolina to do a show with him. Shooting at the club. We all get up out of there. We're flying back together. North Carolina airport. Anybody know this airport? I've been there a few times. And I always look for designated smoke areas that aren't designated smoke areas. So I found a little spot, and it's way at the end of the airport where the parking lot is. There's a long staircase with a long fence. So if you sit there, you can see everything around. You can see 360. If anybody comes up on you, you can put shit out. So we go over there to smoke. Myself, Biggie, Lil C's, and my boy Carlton Fist. We're smoking. Some flight attendants and some pilots walk by. I guess they're going to their vehicles. They're like, ooh, nice smell. No lie. From them saying that, we put the shit out, lit some cigarettes. 5 seconds later, police pull up. What are you guys doing out here? Oh, we're just smoking cigarettes, you know, just chilling. Oh, you guys can't be here. You got a flight? Where you going? No. All, you know, all the regular shit. Long story short, they leave us alone. We go inside the airport. Now, Big, one of the funniest dudes I ever met in my life. So he goes through the metal detector. Metal detector goes off. He tells, it's a sweet little old lady, sweet little old white lady. He tells her, look, can you wand me because I have a bullet in me? The detector's going to keep going off if I keep walking through. She was like, no, you just go through the detector. He goes through again. She was like, one more. He's like, look, lady, can you just? She was like, no, you going through the detector again. He was like, shut up. And he's been saying, this is something he used to say, like somebody, it wasn't shut up like shut up, lady. It was shut up like that was his funny thing he did to everybody, but he just hit her with it at this time. And she looked at him, she was like, what did you say? I'm the supervisor here. I can have you. Boy, she aired his ass. He was like, I was just playing, Ma. Funniest shit I ever seen in my life right there, because she was dead serious and he was still playing. Yeah. Then we get in the airport, we get on the plane, and they gave him a little extra. This is the first time I ever seen this. They gave him the extra belt to put on the seatbelt so he could buckle himself
he's a big man.
Snoring pretty loud. He was snoring pretty loud on that plane, bro.
This is a true story. Yeah. I knew who he was, I was in a San Diego lobby, in a hotel lobby, with a woman, and he was sending drinks with his crew to the woman I was with, and he did it three times, and it was all a test to see if at any point I would object, and he was with a lot of dudes, and at this point, I don't know anything about who he is, and I think it's pretty early in his career, and finally, I just sort of was like, come on, and he actually called me over and respected it. He's like, we just keep doing that to people until they respond, and some don't ever respond.
It took me three.
It's not like I was brave. I was just sort of like, come on, don't. You're going to just keep disrespecting me like that?
That was a boss move. They was trying to get your chick. Spread love. It's the Brooklyn way.
What can you tell me about what happens after Wu-Tang with you, where you head into the entertainment industry? Were there a lot of situations you found yourself in where you're like, how did I get here? I can't believe that all of this has arrived here. This is another way to make a career off of what was my previous career.
Well, I had always dabbled in a little acting here and there because it was thrown in my lap, kind of. And I went on a few auditions and got a couple of parts here and there. And I liked it, but I wasn't as committed. But it came to a point where the Wu-Tang dynasty was becoming a bit suffocating. Moves weren't being made. It got to a point where everyone was a little frustrated and wanted to see if they can explore on their own what they can find. For me, I buckled down. Me and Redman started going overseas a lot, more shows, had to keep the lights on and all that. Plus at home, the shows weren't, basically they didn't want us performing anywhere that, you know, because the market had changed. The whole genre had changed.
You were more popular overseas than you were in America.
Yeah, basically that, because there were so many things going on here in America with a whole new crop of MCs coming in. So after my fifth time that year overseas, of going overseas, I got tired of it, man. It was too much. And I said, there's got to be something else. I mean, I can contribute way more to entertainment than just jumping on stage, shaking my ass for 100, 200 people, 400, 500 people. And I decided from that day forward that when I get back, I'm going to do whatever it takes to break into the acting game. I'm going to take my classes. If I have to sleep on my manager's couch, I will do that. And that's exactly what I did. Went right to LA. No glamour, glitz, no ritzy hotel. I stayed at my manager's house, slept on her couch, went on auditions, took classes, started working out, and really took the craft seriously, because if I didn't, nobody would take me seriously. And I got booked. It was crazy. I got booked in a Key and Peele movie. Thank you, Jordan Peele and Keegan-Michael Key. Thank you, guys. And from there, it just snowballed. And that's when I realized that I was right. I can control. I do have more to contribute to the entertainment field. And now, you know, I go from playing a thug in a Key and Peele movie to playing a lawyer on Stars, which is dope.
You burnt out on rap? You burnt out on hip hop?
Oh, I mean, I love it more than ever now because I have more time to do it. And it's this right here. It's, I do it now because I want to, not because I have to. And if I could take you back to that little boy that loved music, and then that teenager that stood in that staircase and watched people his age do something that he never thought could be done by unprofessionals, yeah, you know I'm going to always love music. I just finished writing like 4 different songs last night, you know?
Are you using much of the stuff in the American air these days to inspire and fuel some of what you're writing? Because America's upside down, the race wars are heavy and awful, and it's not like you haven't lived this stuff for a long time.
Well, I wouldn't call them race wars. I call them ignorance wars, because there's a lot of ignorance going around, misinformation. For me, I am the escape from the ills of reality. I am the guy that says, okay, come party with me for an hour. Come have a drink with me for an hour. Come smoke with me for an hour. Forget all of that stuff. And then when you go back to it, you'll have this fond memory until we meet next time. That's what I'm here for. I'm not saying I'm disconnected from everything that's going on right now, because I'm not. If it affects my people, it affects me. But in the same sense, in the same breath, I want people to be able to take a break every now and then, you know, kick their feet up, sit back, smoke one, maybe take a bath or a hot shower. Just that one moment where you're in your own space to do what you want to do, and then go back to the fight. I'm not saying give up on the fight. Just take some time out for yourself, take care of yourself, relax, release, refresh, rejuvenate, and go back to it.
What is the name of the dog that just came into the room? And tell me more about the dog that just came in.
I can't stand these damn dogs, man. For real.
You can't stand them? What happened? Uh-oh. I don't want to get into a fight with anybody in your house there. They sound small. Are they tiny little dogs?
They chi-chis, hairy chihuahuas.
And you hate them? You want them?
I didn't say hate. I said I can't stand these dogs. Nugget and Bosco. And one's name is Nugget and one's name is Bosco.
So you're just trying to give people relief. So is it a bad idea for me to ask you how you feel when you see Kanye and Lil Wayne and, 50 Cent?
Well, you know what, Dan? I've been watching and I've been seeing it. I mean, it makes you want to scratch your head and you wonder if people are trolling. But then you look at certain individuals' histories and you see exactly their line of thinking. And how could anyone be surprised, you know, to see that, you know? But I'm not speaking for them. They're their own people. They're free thinkers with free will to do what they want to do in their free country. For me, I'm a bit more reserved. I like my privacy. You know, I don't want people to know what I support or how I support it. Because if I'm supporting something, I'd rather be in the background giving and not taking away from the bigger picture. Oh, Method Man's here. No, Method Man's not here. Method Man's standing in the back and he's part of the movement. He's pushing forward with the rest of you guys. So, I mean, they can lean any way they want to lean. For me, it's nobody's business, period. I don't think people should put their religious beliefs, their political beliefs, and all of that into entertainment unless they're going to live and die by these same convictions. You know what I mean? So for me, I'd rather keep my privacy. You know what I mean? I'm here to entertain y'all for now. But trust me, when the revolution starts, and it has started, I'm there.
You didn't do very much in the way of beef, right? Because you're
I don't have beef with nobody. I love everybody, man. I love everybody that love and respect me. You know what I'm saying? You know, I tend not to judge. I don't want to judge people off top. You know, like I said, I mess with those that mess with me. If you don't mess with me, you ain't my kind of people. Then you know what I mean? I hate mean people, and I don't know, Dan. I don't know. It's weird now because a lot of things are going on. And, you know, some days I feel enraged. I'm not going to lie to you. And I want to go outside and scream to the world, you know. Other days I'm a bit more reserved. And it's like I want to listen more instead of act. And I just think that right now in this country, everybody's wanting something because we haven't been getting it for so long. And I don't think anybody actually knows what that is. They're taking it in small doses. I think the higher ups know this. So they're giving it to us in small doses to quell the masses, to keep them in line and in check. But it's no longer working. I think everyone's taking that matrix pill and they want more.
Let me keep it lighter for you then so that we don't delve into areas that are too uncomfortable. Did you know when you were making The Wire that you were making a seminal piece of work that spoke to a time and was attacking the racial condition in a way that was super artistic?
In a sense, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm from that. But, you know, most of the people that tuned into The Wire, they tuned in for the violence. I mean, that's why I feel like David Simon and those guys over there, Nina Noble, are geniuses because they... I mean, that first season set the tone for the rest of the seasons, and they brought attention to Baltimore, whereas no one even considered Baltimore. It was something you passed through on your way to D.C. or to Virginia, you know. Maryland wasn't considered like that. And for them to be residents, not just residents, but, you know, David worked for the newspaper. Ed Byrne, I mean, he worked for, you know, the Baltimore PD. You know, he knew a lot of the gangsters. And that's why I always say it's important for the people who lived it to tell these stories, not people who read it, because the stories are more authentic that way. That's what gave The Wire its genuine authenticity, was the fact that the people who wrote it, the people behind it, were actually residents and from the areas.
That had to be such a cool, creative, artistic time. When have you been most proud of your work? When have you found it most creatively fulfilling? I know that jobs pay and everything else, but where you're just enjoying the art of it, the crafting of it.
Oh, man. The Cobbler, when I did The Cobbler with Adam Sandler, because Tom McCarthy is like one of the best, if not the best director to work with I've ever worked with in my life. And the Lemon Squeeze joint I did with Conway, Griselda Records, and I didn't get a dime for that, you know? So that just lets you know it's all about love and the work for me, you know? And I'm very proud of that work there because people are saying it's like verse of the year. I don't know if you heard it yet, but...
No, please, let me hear it right now, please.
You got to go on. I ain't got it. Well, I got it, but you got to go on and get that, bro.
Send it's it like to me. I want to
hear. Conway the Machine, Griselda. Griselda Records. His name is Conway the Machine. It's From King to a God is the album. So anybody tuning in right now, that's the album. And It's got Verse of the Year on there for Method Man.
what do you make of the state of hip hop today? Like today, not, and this isn't to say anything. I know you don't say anything negative about people. And like you say, you're living a spiritually zen life when you're spending a lot of time not judging people and making sure that you're not the one who says shitty things about people that allow others to, you know, feast on it. So I get that. But the state of hip hop today.
I will slap the shit out somebody, though. Pardon my phrase, but I will still slap the shit out somebody.
Okay, fair enough. But the state of hip hop today is what, according to you? Are you going to sound like an old man and say?
No. The state of hip hop, I think it's you know what? It's moving into I think it's moving into a good space. I'm digging a lot of the material that's coming out now. A lot of these kids is rapping, you know? They call it mumble rap. I call it melodic rap. It had its moment, you know? But now they're moving on to the next. And I like a lot of the new stuff that's coming out right now, you know? Even this Roddy Ricch kid, oh my goodness. Like, I was listening to his stuff and he's phenomenal, man. He's really, really good, bro.
I don't find that people your age who come from this game are welcoming to the younger rappers. I feel like they do dismiss it as mumble rap a great deal. Snoop is very negative on that subject.
No. You know what it is? Because some of these guys, you could tell. I mean, you could just tell. And it's flooded with so much of it. Some of these guys, you could just hear it like, They sound like they should be rhyming in the 80s. The words they putting together and stuff. And then, and not only that, they biting somebody else's style that's a little bigger than them. So it's like, it becomes repetitive. And we don't like that. We don't like that. And most of all, we was all about lyrics in them days. If you couldn't put two rhyming words together and have them sentences before that rhyming word makes sense, you ain't rhyming. And a lot of guys are stuck in their ways like that. And ain't nothing wrong with that. I respect lyricism to the fullest too. But I also respect cadence, flow. And if you got a great flow and your record sound like a record, brother, you doing it right. You know what I'm saying? And that's not taking nothing away from my lyrical brothers, because I'm a lyricist myself. I'm straight lyrics. You know what I mean? But you guys know that a lot of the stuff that came out in the 90s, disregarding all the guys that y'all feel are legends, a lot of the stuff that came out in the 90s was straight trash. Keep it a buck. It was garbage. Go back and do your history. Go on YouTube, put in 90s hip hop video and watch it for yourself. Well, this shit with the hands, they was doing this shit with the hands. I hated that shit. This shit here with the hands. What is that? What is that? Who started that?
Can you give me a craftsman or a craftsperson that you have admired because they're hitting all the notes in a way that even Method Man says, holy shit, I don't think I can get there.
Michael Jackson. I mean, I don't think anybody could ever touch that catalog right there. He's touched on everything from rock, rap, soul. I mean, everything. Nobody.
Maybe his sister. She's one.
Well, see, that's, she's my Valentine every year. I get a pass. That's my Valentine every year. Miss Janet Jackson.
You get a pass. You get a pass at home.
Yeah, it's just Janet Jackson. It's fun. It's just games. Let's not get anybody beat up or anything like that, or, you know, start a Twitter feud or anything like that. It's just fun and games. Janet Jackson's not actually my Valentine every year. I'm having fun. Jesus Christ. But Michael, catalog, done everything. And, you know, I missed him by 5 minutes. Ghost and Ray got to meet him at the studio. Ghostface Killah and Raekwon the Chef. And I got there late. Of all the days to be late. Because I would have tried to get Michael to say a cuss word. I would have been like, say shit, Michael. Just say it one time. Say motherfucker. I'm pretty sure Mike cursed. I'm pretty sure he did. He probably didn't curse in front of people, though, because he was such a classy gentleman. You know what I mean? But, yeah, I'm pretty sure Mike threw an F-bomb every now and then.
Meth, good catching up with you. Thank you for making the time. I am sorry about everything happening with your Jets. I am deeply, deeply sorry.
Hey. We're not having a moment of silence yet. And you know what happens. One man's trash is another man's first pick in the draft.
He doesn't want to play there. I'm sorry.
Hey, everyone loves to come to New York, okay? Everybody. They just don't want to play for the Jets. And that's sad. Oh, one question, Dan. One question really fast. Should I start Higgins or should I start, I don't know. I want to put McKinnon in. Should I put McKinnon in or Higgins?
Higgins is good with Mayfield. I don't think that he is good in general, but I don't think that your guy Odell there leaving the lineup hurts Higgins because for some reason Mayfield can connect with Higgins. And Odell Beckham is no longer an exceptional receiver when he plays in Cleveland, which has been heartbreaking because I know you enjoyed those Giants years.
Yeah, I did. They were cool. Now, what about Higgins? What about Slayton or Higgins?
I'd still go Higgins there. I'm sorry to do this to you. Keep going Higgins there. You said one question. I'm not even any kind of fantasy expert. I've just got an executive producer who loves the Cleveland Browns.
Okay. I got it. Dan, thank you, brother. Miami's quarterback, Tua.
You're going to ask me another?
Yeah, I want to know. I'm not asking should I start him. I have him on my team, actually, but I'm not starting
him. His footwork is good. His hips are good. His hips are real fluid. His leadership is good. But Aaron Donald's a problem. So, you know, don't judge him on this week.
Got you.
Call me if you want my sports opinions. We don't have to do this on here where you sneak them in at the end.
I know you're a busy guy, Dan. I appreciate you, brother.
Likewise, sir. Thank you to Method Man there. And thank you as well to you guys who support all this nonsense that we do because the way that you support it, we are feeling it this last week more than we have ever felt it because you really buy in on the Lebatard and Friends properties. You could rate, subscribe, and review. I don't know if I've ever told you guys how the t-shirt business works here, but the way our merch business works is that Disney has sort of slotted people where they can be in the hierarchy of pay, and there are times that I don't feel like that's quite enough. So the reason that Stugatz has lent his likeness to and the reason that I don't take any money from the t-shirt business other than a fund meant to support show projects is so that the shipping container can feel supported, get a little extra coin. And so lebatardaf.shop is where you go if you want to buy the Chris Cody merch, because stuff with their likeness is where you will find a way to just get a little extra change to the guys who you love. So Lebatard and Friends, support that stuff where you can. And thank you again for making us feel so supported over the last 10 days or so.